Before rock and roll, before pop, before everything, there was the blues, the music of struggle, triumph, and truth. Welcome to Talking Blues, where we honor the legends and tell the stories that shape modern music. Here's your host, Matt Cooper.
Our guest today is Adam Gusso. He's a blues harmonica player with decades under his belt and a professor of English and Southern Studies at the University of Mississippi, where he's been teaching the blues music, culture, and literature for close to 15 years now. In terms of blues street cred, Adam spent 25 years playing with Sterling, Mr. Satan McGee. Some of you might remember from the sidewalks of Harlem tearing it up in the 80s and early 90s on the festival stages. That kind of partnership leaves a mark. Okay, when Adam talks about the blues, he's not quoting, he's remembering. And Adam's written three award-winning books on the blues. His latest, My Family and I, is what I'm listening to right now on Audible. It's raw. It's personal. It's honest in a way that only someone who's walked through the fire can really share with you. Now, here's the big picture, guys. If you're old enough to remember Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of a beloved community where the content of their character judges people, not the color of their skin. Adam's been trying to live that out on stage and off for 40 plus years now. We're going to talk about that, about his latest book, and about the long, hard, beautiful road of a blues man. Please welcome Adam Gusso.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to be here. Really great to be here on Talking Blues.
Great to have you here. And I was, you were talking a little bit about over email about the latest book, and I was sharing with you how it kind of upset me illuminated my thinking all at once. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but and you know, you're also saying to me during the email that some of your friends said, you know, Adam, maybe he shouldn't put this out, but you did. Give me some insight into how you finally came to say, okay, it's time to put this on paper.
Yeah, well, and of course, I'm sure you'll do something like this, but I should share the cover photo, which is me and my wife now of 21 years, and our son. At that point, he was about 2 months old, named Sean. The folks who said you shouldn't do this, that was not about the book per se, but it was about a sort of long prologue, which is something I wrote back in 2021. I'm trying to think about the best way of framing this. So you might assume that as somebody interracially married and living in Mississippi, raising the son that my wife and I have had, call him biracial, call him just an American kid, Mississippi boy, a black boy from Mississippi like Richard Wright. I mean, you might all those different names. You might assume then that I'm hard left and that I'm actually hard woke. And the truth is, I'm an old school liberal, and you framed it when you talked about beloved or beloved community, because that's what my book is about. I'm an old school liberal who, at a certain point in recent American history, and I know that you Canadians have had their own challenges with this, felt that the left liberal coalition that I was a part of, I felt that it had suddenly drifted or swerved hard left in a way. I come from a family that was progressive. My father was a delegate for George McGovern. He worked for Bobby Kennedy in Oregon in 1968. We were all heartbroken when King and then Kennedy were assassinated. So I come from that kind of a family that is naturally aligned with, I'd say, broadly progressive values. And obviously, I want a world where my wife and my son and I can all live and pursue our happiness, the sort of Declaration of Independence ideal. And what I found at a certain point was that the American left had sort of gone in the opposite direction. And instead of saying, we're going to try to get to a place that's egalitarian, that is, what's the word, where we're just all in a fraternity, in a sort of broadly based multiracial coalition, what they did was basically say, white folks are there, black folks are there, we're going to capitalize B, capitalize W. If you ever thought there was a chance of getting it together in a transracial way, which had been my life with Mr. Satan, it had been my life in this marriage, a transracial love and alliance and creative partnership. What I found was the left was saying basically, no, we're going to sort you guys into that category on the basis of your immutable characteristic, which is to say we think of you as white, even though I think of myself as a half Lithuanian, Russian, Jewish, half Scotch, Irish, Dutch mutt, right? You're white. You're black with a capital B. Your son, well, we're not sure which room we're going to send him to when we have the re-education thing, which is how we're going to transform American culture by hyper-racializing everybody. And what I wanted to do was have that moment where the record drags across the groove, that kind of, that's how my book begins. That's the prologue with that, which, I mean, we can talk about this and unpack it, but that's where I'm coming from, is as an old school liberal who truly believes in creating a multiracial world. I'm living it. I've been living it for a long time, and who felt that the left had left me behind. But of course, we live in a very different moment right now. We have a very different president than I imagined we might have when we were about to publish the book. So let's have the conversation. Matt, I really would like to do that. But that's sort of, that's the initial dump. That's where my book is coming from. And there's a lot else in it, but that's where it starts with what doesn't work. What doesn't work.
You can pick up your copy on Amazon. Like I say, I've got it on Audible. And Adam, I was going through some of your papers as well as you share with your students, and I came across a concept that I don't know anybody else that I can ask this question of and get the kind of answer that I'm looking for our listeners.
All right.
I came across this quote, and it's the concept that even amongst black intellectual circles, there's a range of opinions about what the blues are and where they came from. And I'm wondering if you can give us some insights in terms of the black nationalist perspective versus the blues universalist perspective on the blues.
Sure. So actually, what we're talking about is kind of the last book that I published before my family and I, which was called Whose Blues. I said, in a sense, there's two ideologies that in the current moment seem to govern the way that people talk about blues when they argue about blues, as opposed to when they just sip a little scotch and or bourbon and listen to blues and dance to blues. And the two ideologies are what I call blues universalism and black bluesism. So blues universalism would be caricatured with the phrase, no white, no black, just the blues. And I talk about the problematics of that in that book. What's the problematics? Well, if you say no white, no black, I understand you're trying to get to that transracial world. But some people hear no black, especially in Mississippi, where, you know, many of the greatest blues performers of all time, who happened to, almost all of them except for Charlie Musselwhite, maybe, happen to be black. And they hear no black like you're trying to erase blackness from the blues, and that doesn't work. So it's sort of misheard by people. On the other side, and I
Corey Harris.
Yeah. Why am I blocking on his name? Because I'm thinking about this other book. So it's just my 67-year-old brain. The author of Down Home Sophisticate, wonderful player. But he was like, the moment white folks come anywhere near the blues, there's a problem. They're always trying to rip us off. They're trying. They can't play it. They can't sing it. They're trying to make money off it. They're making it into a joke like the Blues Brothers. And so blues is black music with a capital B. What's the problem with that? And I sort of talk in Whose Blues about the problematics of that, which is, if you think that white folks got into the blues in the 60s and like for the first time, you're missing all kinds of interesting stories. The fact that in fact, white performers were recorded, they recorded blues in the teens before black performers got to be recorded. The fact that there were white and black blues songwriting teams early on. And of course, in the 50s, Yakety Yak, Don't Talk Back, you know, you had Lieber and Stoller. You're sort of missing a whole part of the conversation. So you're missing the fact that Buddy Guy is covering Cream, right? Covering Sunshine of Your Love. You miss the fact, so white blues songwriters are a big deal. You're missing the fact that there are some white people who make a joke out of blues, but on the other hand, there's some like Bonnie Raitt who never did, and in fact, spent her career trying to lift up people she learned from, the Furry Lewises and Sippy Wallaces of the world. So that it would be fair to say that what I'm trying to do in that book was I was trying to kind of complicate the story about the blues. I don't know if that answers your question, but maybe it gets an answer going. You'll tell me.
Well, certainly starts the conversation, sir. And I want to touch also on your latest book, because that's had quite an impact on me. And I like to think that I am a bit of an armchair musicologist / historian, nothing official, of course, but you know, I'm fascinated by Black history, and I don't want to go down a rabbit hole, although I live down a rabbit hole. The book really freaked me out, Adam. It freaked me out of what I don't know how many spoilers I want to give, but you know, like give a few. About trading black genitals in fruit jars? Okay, that kind of blew me off this chair there. Like that just like I can't even fathom that kind of thinking. And I don't know if you want to talk any more about that, but that go ahead.
Yeah. So that particular image. So it was in the framework of, I was talking about my education as a guy who, you know, college and a MA degree, and then I was a street musician in Harlem, and then I went back to graduate school and sort of remanufactured myself into a blues scholar. And one of the things that happened early on in my education, I was a PhD candidate at Princeton in 94-95, in one of my very first seminars, which was about the Harlem Renaissance, I became aware of the whole history of lynching in America, which is something that should have been a part of my history, right? It shouldn't have had to wait until I was 10 years out of undergraduate before I heard about this. But it was a period of time, the mid to late 90s, when more people were writing about this. And what I got interested in, interested is the wrong word, I became kind of obsessed with, transfixed with, was the idea that there'd been this period in American history, starting in the 1890s, with Mississippi, Texas, and Georgia being three of the worst places, where you'd not only had lynching per se, like stringing somebody up, usually a black man, for various reasons, often on a pretext. In other words, the sort of raping a white woman charge was usually a pretext, not always. Or killing a sheriff, sometimes they did kill white sheriffs. But there were lots of getting too uppity, right? But not only did that happen, but that it happened before large crowds. It happened before crowds of 10,000 people. White people would come out and take excursion trains and have a picnic, and they would watch a guy be tortured for hours in some cases. They thought that was appropriate for their kids. So this chapter of American history, terribly, it's a grievous chapter, to the extent that, you know, we had a period of wokeness in America. I'm all in favor of the fact that we need to know that this history is out there. And it sounds like this history may have been something you hadn't seen before. It's something that I dealt with for a period of time. And I ended up trying to connect the emergence of what was called spectacle lynching with the emergence of the blues. Now, I had a lot of blues fans, aficionados, when I would share some ideas about this online in those early discussion rooms, there were people who would say, oh, you're crazy, we're crazy. And then, but here, there were two, missing links, if it's wrong, it's a bad phrase, but there were two things that convinced me that I was on the right track. One of them was B.B. King, who in 1968, when he was really starting to ride really high, he had crossed over in 68. There was a quote that I found from B.B. King in an interview, and he said, you know, back where I come from in Mississippi, my people have been killed so many ways. He said that, you know, it really makes you afraid. He said, and then you'll think about that. And he was talking about lynching. You'll think about that in the back of your mind. And he said, it'll really get to you. And he said, that's where my blues comes from. He goes, the next most important thing is your woman. There's a whole lot of blues fans. You and I both, in my case, it was failed love that sort of plunged me into the blues. So it's easy for most of us to say, yeah, if you have a terrible breakup, you love that woman, so she's with somebody else. I mean, that's the foundation of the blues. B.B. King was saying, well, I sing about that stuff. I don't really sing about the lynching, except in one case of Why I Sing the Blues. He did that one song, which sort of hints at a lot of black collective troubles, slavery and everything else. But I think that that convinced me there was something there. And I went into it and researched it deeply. And that became my first, it became my dissertation. It became my first book, which was called Seems Like Murder Here, Southern Violence and the Blues Tradition. So I'm glad that this book put some of that in your corner. Maybe, I mean, I can, there are other books that one might read, but going back to my first, Seems Like Murder Here would be a good one. Yeah.
It, it sounds like it. And revisionist history has been painted over the reality to the extent where people are blind to it. And yeah, I you know, I'm grateful and to you for bringing this kind of thing out, because people need to know. And what brings to mind immediately is a conversation I had with the great Bob Margolin, Muddy Waters' right-hand man, guitar player, just a few days ago. Had Bob on the show.
Really?
And Bob was talking, reminiscing about some of the times he had with Muddy and how Muddy would be traveling the Chitlin' Circuit back south when he was touring. And it was common knowledge that, you know, when you were on that circuit, when you were stopping in a town, you'd want to stop where other black folks were. Safety in numbers. And Muddy would recall a quick story. Bob tells it better than I do, where Muddy would walk up to a gentleman and said, sir, where do all the black folks hang out? And the gentleman said, right under that tree.
There's a story that Johnny Shines tells that's in my in my book. Where he said he was trying to, he was saying, you know, I didn't want to be in Mississippi. I met a woman when I came down from Memphis to into Mississippi, and she goes, I don't want you hanging around my place. And he said, thank you, ma'am. And, you know, I don't want you hanging out around my place, right? But I don't want you hanging around my place. It's like, oh, thank you, ma'am. Thank you. It's a white lady who doesn't want me to be lynched. So one of the things that blues people did, it's important, this is deep in the blues, which is they use humor against that horrible thing, right? And that's something that I've been really interested in is, you know, it's not just pure abjection. It's not just we're helpless here. It's we got to find strategies for survival. And I do think that a lot of the blues traces back to those strategies for survival, including my own long-term partner, Mr. Satan, Sterling McGee, who used to, when I would complain about a girlfriend that didn't work out, and he'd say, hell, I've had so many wives die on me, I was thinking of opening a funeral parlor. And then he'd sort of have this harsh laugh. And it was that harsh laugh that taught me something. Right? It's because I knew, look, this is a man who had been so broken up. People told me in Harlem when I was hanging out, they go, well, you know, man, he had a wife. She was really beautiful. They'd make their hands like she was curvy. And then she died of cancer, and he was there, and then he went crazy. And that's when he changed his name from Sterling McGee to Satan. So I knew the backstory that he'd really cared about this woman named Betty. I saw a photo of her much later, but I didn't. But I thought, instead of complaining about that, he's laughing it off. He's slapping it away. That's the blues way. And I do think that kind of part of what I call the blues ethos when I teach the blues, you know, that the philosophy of life. Yeah.
And if you want to learn more about the blues, you'd be do well to study Adam's work. Get over to Amazon or wherever it is that you buy great literature. I've got a lot of blues harp discussion coming up, but I want to take you back a little bit, folks, to downstate New York, late 50s, when Adam came across the planet. And your dad, as you mentioned, Alan Gusso, great painter, and I understand killer record collection that he used to sort of steer you towards when you'd be sort of bugging him in his studio. Kind of tunes you'd be hearing, you know, Bob Dylan, jazz. I understand Sgt. Pepper was one of the first copies hit your street in 67. Tell us about some of those tunes and the influences there.
You know, so my dad was a wonderful artist, and I've been going through his work actually in the process of clearing out my late mother's house. It's in Piermont now, which is the county just north of New York, west of the Hudson. That's where I'm from. I'm from Congers, a little town. My dad had he was kind of a jazz record collector, but he had incredibly wide tastes. So Charles Ives, I've been going through his records too. All this classical stuff, Ravi Shankar, again, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, which is one of the records that I remember distinctly. He just played the hell out of that thing. And in fact, that's where I first heard the song Oxford Town, all because color of skin is brown, right? I mean, like, I had never, didn't know what Oxford Town meant. It meant 1962, James Meredith, the big riot that was at the university where I've spent 23 years, right? And my family, my son is going to Oxford. He's going to the University of Mississippi. That's about the University of Mississippi. Well, all of that history is encoded in the records. But I what I heard was this thing called a harmonica. And then I heard a lot of blues of the sort of Count Basie, boogie woogie, James P. Johnson, that sort of old stride piano, boogie woogie piano from the old Southern juke joints. There was a lot of that. Bessie Smith, Fletcher Henderson, a lot of Fletcher Henderson. That was the kind of jazz stuff my dad collected. I didn't really get any sense of sort of racial difference in the music, although every now and then he'd talk about Miff Mole. And he'd say, that's kind of corny. So to the extent that there was, but Benny Goodman, he loved, right? So it's not like all white musicians who played this music were corny, but I did get some sense that there was that category of stuff. At one point I took about 10 of my dad's jazz 78s, it's a big stack. And he had some country. So he listened a lot to Jimmy Rogers, the singing brakeman from Meridian, Mississippi, who did blues that was country music in a sense, early country. And Doc Watson, my dad had great taste. He had a lot of Doc Watson. And I took a stack of 10 records and I brought them downstairs. I had an old turntable. We were really into like old technology in my house. He had a wire recorder, the prelude to the tape recorder, which is a very strange thing. We would record ourselves on it. I took it down and I played that stack of records through, turn it over, play all 10 again, do it again. It was like 10 records at a time. It's like, what's that, half an hour of music? So just played it forever. And that, I think, put that boogie-woogie beat in me. Now, I grew up in a non-religious family, so there was never any sense that this is the devil's music. It was just music. It was just what was there, along with some 78s, I mean, some 33, some Louis Armstrong records and that kind of stuff. And that's where it all started. I my background as a musician was I played a little bit of piano. My mom, we had an old upright piano. She put tacks on the keys to make it sound like a harpsichord, and she would play Bach sometimes. I played Turkey in the Straw, which now I recognize was a blackface minstrel song from back in the day, but da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's where I learned a little counterpoint. But it all faded away. The flutophone faded away, and that was it. I had no musical instrument really until, and we're going to get into the harmonica thing, until the fall of 1974 when I was a senior. I was a skipped ahead, so I was a smart ass, young kind of senior. When I said, everybody in school loves this, the J. Giles Band. They love that album called J. Giles Band Live Full House. They love the song called Whammer Jammer. And I said, I didn't know how to do that, but I said, I am going to use my brains and I'm going to up my status in this class. I was thought of as the smart, clueless guy, right? Like, would not know that kind of music, but I had developed a secret love for this music. So I went to a local mall, the Nanuet Mall in Nanuet, New York. And what back then in 74, what could you get? I got a Arnie Blackie Schachner, How to Play Harmonica. Then I got the album, the Tony Little Son Glover, Blues Harp, which had a sort of wild-looking black eye on the cover. It might have had a headband, or it was the guy with glasses who, you know, was really Reverend Dan Smith, sunglasses. But it was, and that was like, wow, that voice, right? The voice that he had. And I got a couple of harmonicas. I got at least a C, maybe a C and an A. I realized I needed the A because that's what Whammer Jammer was on. And I began to try to teach myself. And that's how it started. It was just me and the records. And then eventually, bit by bit, I managed to kind of glom on to records that people had, like a drama teacher gave me Mississippi Mandolin, Johnny Young with Paul Osher on harp. So it's interesting that who I came to know, Paul Osher, who was, you know, the first white guy to play with Muddy Waters. I had no idea. He's just on this Johnny Young album, and his stuff was simple. So I could, you know, train fare out of town, and I would just jam along with it. And that's sort of how it worked. And try to make sense of Tony Glover, whose tabs didn't really quite work for me, but the voice that he had, and I have to say the ear that he had for the good music, for like Sonny Boy Williamson, meaning Rice Miller, and Jimmy Reed. He mentioned James Cotton. There were a few other key people, Sonny Terry, right? So that's it. Also, and so then I'm going looking for the albums that he's talking about or the artists he's talking about. So I went and got Sonny Terry. And I guess I will play a little bit of the first Sonny Terry song I ever learned how to play, if you want. But that's how it started.
So it's Magic Dick's harp that's kind of catches mm-hmm. you right off the bat with Wham Jam. Okay. And then safe to say that you're kind of focusing on the Three Kings at the same time. Yeah, Albert, BB, and Freddie.
I was playing guitar at the same time. So, yeah, I was going and learning how to play, trying to teach myself how to play blues guitar from the albums, basically. Yeah. So here's the thing. The thing that fascinated me was the blue note, you know, that blues tonality. Now, I've learned through the years, I mean, I'll talk about this in my class. You can say, well, it's not major, it's not minor. It's actually, if you think about what I call the blue third, and I'm going to get to the difference between guitar playing and harmonica playing, but basically guitar players and harmonica players each found their own way of finding that note that was halfway in between major and minor. So when I demonstrate, I might say the first three lines for an American audience, fifth, third root, and that third is a major third. Imagine that same thing with a minor third. Very different sound, right? What the blues does, and what did I do, is I flatted the harmonica down to from a major to a minor. What blues does is take the note in between minor and major. So playing blues guitar, the way you produce that note is you hit a minor third, which is very visible on the fretboard, and then you squeeze it up. And we didn't have YouTube, so I didn't get to see people do that. But I realized that, you know, that they would talk about it in the instructional book that I had. You sort of push it up. Dim, dim, you know, that's the kind of Muddy Waters. So that trying to find that note and trying to learn how to bend and then learn how to control the bend was something that you can spend a lifetime on. What I would say is that the guitar players taught me where it was, because I'd push that minor third up a little, squeeze it up a little. So anybody who said, well, they would say the blues scale is like they'd say it's the minor third on the guitar, but then, you know, if they were honest, they'd say, but you sort of squeeze it up, and you can do that with almost every note, is sort of manipulate the microtone. The harmonica is the same thing, and I think it really made it easier for me to think about those, working with those two things together, except that on the harmonica, you're pulling it down. On the guitar, you're squeezing it up. You're squeezing the minor third up a little. On the harmonica, you're pulling the major third down a little, and that's what makes it tricky.
Fascinating stuff. And we're going to talk more about your harmonica channel and your affiliation with Hohner. You know, can we skip ahead a little bit just after Princeton to Nat Riddles? You know, because Nat kind of came into the scene before you met Satan, and kind of a good timing too, because Nat played kind of a key role in your development there. Let's talk about Nat Riddles and, you know, the effect he had on you. He's a very unique guy.
So Nat Riddles was my harmonica teacher. And I had gone 10 years from fall of 74 into the spring of 70 of 85 without really ever taking a harmonica lesson and without really being in the presence of somebody who could potentially be my harmonica teacher. And I tell the story in Mr. Satan's Apprentice. Nat was driving a cab down Amsterdam Avenue past the where the front gates of Columbia University that are now locked to the public. He was kind of driving there, and I had jammed with some band on campus at night, and I was walking down the street doing the thing that I did, which was sort of. Sort of moving all over the harp, kind of bebop, a little beboppy kind of stuff. And Nat heard me through his cab door and kind of came around and pulled up next to me. And he leaned over, very dark skinned, black New Yorker with New York accent. "Hey, man, was that you?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I thought it was it's good. I thought I ought to see who it was." Well, Nat at that point had a whole career playing with Larry Johnson, with Odetta, playing in all the Gerdes Folk City, all the New York downtown places. He'd recorded. Horst Lippmann had brought him over with Larry to record in Germany. Horst is the guy who did the American Folk Blues Festival. I knew none of this. And so there he was sort of moonlighting as a cabbie. And he got out of his car and he had a toolkit. He sort of opened the toolkit and there is harps. And he did something like this. And I'm like, "What the hell is that? That's the real thing. I've been listening to the records. He's like a record come to life." And so we became friends. He was my teacher. I only had a couple of formal lessons for which I paid him $25. He was the one who sort of said, open your hands. You know, when he first came to my apartment, I followed him all summer. 1985, I was a dropout from Columbia, from grad school at Columbia. I had a master's. My girlfriend ran off with a guy that I knew in graduate school. So you could say, "Oh, that's George Carlin would roast me." He'd go, "Oh, sounds horrible. That's the white blues. Graduate school." Fair enough. But I still was determined to learn the music, you know? And I followed Nat. He had a mouse amp like I did. And he would gig on the streets of New York. I actually, at one point, I taped him somewhat later, 1989, 1990. And I've released that. There's a whole sort of Nat Riddle's double LP of street recordings that I got from him. But what Nat had, first of all, he had incredible tone. He had what I didn't have, which is he had a much broader knowledge of the tradition. So I had seen James Cotton open for the J. Giles Band in the spring of 75. I'd seen a little bit of pro harp here and there, but not a lot. And I had never heard of Big Walter Horton. I'd never heard of Sugar Blue. And he was like, "Well, you got Sugar Blue's the man." I mean, and then I'd never heard of Kim Wilson. And he would do all of the stuff that he had gotten from Kim. It's interesting. He used to go and see Kim Wilson in like 82, he would see him at the Beacon. He talked to me about Kim. So what do I get from Nat? Number one is he doesn't care if you're white or black. If you can really play, if you can really throw down, whether you're Kim Wilson or Sugar Blue, it doesn't matter. If you can really play, that's what he's interested in, and that's what he's pushing at me. So my whole transracial brotherhood in the blues and elsewhere thing, in part, it was very much stimulated by Nat, who was – he'd learned from Jewish guys. He learned from Bob Shatkin and Lenny Rabinowitz. He would talk about these guys like they were legends too. And Danny Russo, who recorded on the Spivey record label in the late 70s. Later I got to know Len Kunstadt, who was the guy who owned Spivey and what's her name? Married, the blues singer from the 20s, Victoria Spivey.
Is he?
Spivey. I don't know if it's Spivey or Spivey. Yeah. So that's what I got from Ned. He taught me that summer. I went down and watched him perform with Charlie Hilbert, his guitar player, who I later teamed up with. I watched him busk. And I was trying to write a novel, believe it or not, about how the busking life in Europe had changed me, helped heal me, and helped open me to a whole different world there. And so like but there was the guy. I mean, that was a god. He would talk about El Cafe Street. There is no cover. There's no minimum. He had his way of preaching to the public. He was a gifted communicator and a gifted musician, a gifted harmonica player, not a gifted singer. An okay singer, but he wasn't a great singer, but he could put a song across. And I wrote about him a lot in Mr. Satan's Apprentice and a little bit in My Family and I.
Both books you should be picking up. And so Nat Riddles gave you really your first authentic harmonica instruction and also opened you up to transracial brotherhood, which was a beautiful introduction to meeting Satan, which happened a little bit later. I'm thinking that would be 86, 87.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, and you'll probably get to this at some point. A documentary came out in 2019 or 2018, but it was on Netflix here in the States for a couple of years, 2019 to 2021, called Satan and Adam. It was something I'm really happy is out there. It was not my creation, but I was interviewed a number of times, and the filmmaker, Scott Balsarek, sort of assembled all of this stuff. So he sort of gave the public a sense of our story. Where was I going with that? I was going with something. Oh, okay. The one thing I'll say about the film, it gives a slightly misleading idea of how I came into Harlem, because it makes it sound like one moment this grad student has his heart broken, the next moment he's wandering around Harlem hoping black people will heal his soul, and he runs into this Mr. Satan. There was 2.5 years between the breakup in grad school and running into Mr. Satan in October of 86. In the middle of that was the summer of 85, when I followed Nat and when I took lessons from Nat. Nat's not mentioned in the film, my teacher. So that's a sort of something that's missing. And that's, if it hadn't been for Nat, I wouldn't have gone back to Europe in the summer of 86 for a couple of months and played all over, including solo. I played with several different guitar players. And then came back to America, said, it's time to put the busking life behind. And I got a straight job tutoring writing in the South Bronx. And I'm driving through Harlem, where I had played in the jazz clubs a little. And I write about that in My Family and I. I'd actually broken in the jazz clubs. I was kind of this white guy sensation, because there were no other white guys coming in with harmonica who could play somewhat, sitting in with the players they had, the jazz players and the soul players. So I'd had that background. I went to Europe. Then I come home and I'm driving through Harlem. And that's when I saw, they said, that's Satan. Everybody in Harlem knows Satan. When I asked who it was. And that's when the rest of my life really started. But if it hadn't been for Nat teaching me how to tongue block, telling me to go who I should be listening to, I wouldn't have really had what it took, which was just enough after all of that experience, all of that mileage, as Ralph Macchio, Lightning Boy, says in the movie Crossroads. I'd gotten 2.5 years of mileage on my own and with Nat's help and with others. I'd been around the world. So Harlem is in my city. But of course, in 86, it's 99% black. It's not a place white people hang out. And yet there I was just last night, I should tell you, Matt. I've been going through the possessions of my mom, and I found a video, and it said Satan and Adam 4/12/89. It's a full length. It's like a full set from the street with a full interview with me at 31. It was very weird for my 19-year-old kids. Like, Dad, that's you? You got red hair. And that was after 2.5 years of playing with Mr. Satan, summer of 89. That's before we went and recorded Harlem Blues beginning in February of 1990. But like, we have a sound that's developed that's really pretty close to what ended up on Harlem Blues. And it was very strange to see that and to realize it was like my wife, who'd heard a lot about this and had seen the documentary, but like, there was Mr. Satan at length playing his stuff, doing his incredibly charismatic thing. He would grimace and move. It's just, he was into the music. He gave off joy. And there I am, looking kind of preppy. It was weird. Everybody back then in sort of light blue jeans, and it's a cool day in Harlem in early April. And I'm wearing a pullover, black pullover sweater. I just, like, we were an odd couple. And yet there we were. And the guy who taught, I don't know where the video came from, but it was a black interviewer. So clearly that's who photographed us at length and then interviewed me at length. Very strange. But anyway, that there was 4 years on the street in Harlem where we got our sound together. And then we hit the big time. And we can talk about that. But yeah, lots to talk about with the Harlem experience, I think.
And very volatile streets in New York, 85, 86, 87, a lot of racial tension going on. I mean, there has been for years, but as I recall, those were very trying times. And another kind of interesting development of that, in addition to the fact that your building blocks were built by Nat, that the student was ready, the teacher appeared, that was a natural progression for you, that if that hadn't happened, the future would not have unfolded that way. But it did. And so you're busy, you and Mr. Satan are busy, and then, you know, Bono and the Edge walk up and go, hey, these guys are like the real deal here, because they were busy filming Rattle and Hum around the corner. That was right after the Joshua Tree release, I believe, in 87. Give us some insight. I mean, you're rocking away, and then you look over and there's the Edge, you know, digging what you're doing. Can you give us some insight into that memory?
Well, yeah. So I don't have much of a memory. I have some, but it's so the thing to understand about me is that I vague after it happened, somebody said, you know who that was? That was U2. And I said, well, they're like a big rock group, right? In other words, that was the limit of my knowledge. I have heard of them. I didn't have any of their albums. I didn't really understand that they were just about the biggest damn thing in the world in 87. They were a very, very big group. What I can tell you is that we were playing whatever day it was the spring of 87. So we'd only been together for less than a year. And I was still sitting because later I stood up, but at first it seemed politically unwise to be standing when he was sitting. So at first I sat in a chair. I think I had a cowboy hat early on. And what I remember vaguely is that you didn't see many white people in Harlem. Just we were right next door, though, to the Studio Museum in Harlem. And sometimes buses would pull up while we were playing and a whole bunch of white folks would get out. But by and large, you didn't see white people very much at all. And there were a couple of guys kind of in my frame of view. I'm in the music. I think any musician in your audience can imagine. You're playing harmonica. We're not always like looking out and paying a lot of attention. So I'm sort of, I have a vague sense as I play that there's a couple of guys out there. I don't recognize them. So I don't go, oh my God, it's, oh my God, it's you too. I'm hearing the Dave Chappelle voice. Oh my God. Oh my God. I had no idea who it was. They were there for about 2 minutes, as far as I could tell, and then they're gone. And when we took a break, Bobby Robinson, who was sort of an informal or de facto kind of manager for Mr. Satan, Bobby Robinson is a legend in the world of, certainly of black blues record men. He was one of the guys. The Fire and Fury labels, he was the one who recorded Wilbert Harrison doing Kansas City. He told me that story, and I retell it in Mr. Satan's Apprentice. Bobby Robinson was there, and apparently Bobby had taken a card from these guys, and he was the one who sort of said, well, I'll see what they want. I'll see what they want. And what ended up happening, here's how the story goes. It's a sort of strange story, is that it got back to me that they had said, hey, we'd like to put these guys, your guys. We were not known as Satan and Adam. We were Mr. Satan and the white boy who plays with him, Adam. That's Adam. But it was not Satan and Adam until we had to call our first demo something in the summer of 1990. We were not Satan and Adam. We were just, we were an unnamed act. They said, we'd like to put your guys in the movie. It'll be great promo for them. We can't afford to pay you. And they said, apparently Bobby said, well, if you can't afford to pay us, we can't afford to be used. And I thank him for that. And what ended up happening? And we ended up getting $1,000 each for the rights sort of in perpetuity to use us in the film. So they used us in the film. And that's all I ever got. I don't know what Sterling got, but I think he got a bit more eventually. But that's all we ever got. Years later, I'm just going to tell you, years later, I heard a story about that involved tens of thousands of dollars of cash and And I never saw anything more than that $1,000 for my, I should just say the song that we played. Freedom for My People. So that was the harmonica part that I came up with to go with the wonderful song that he wrote and the guitar part that he was playing. But again, there was a story about lots and lots of money changing hands, none of which I ever saw. So, you know, it seems like everybody involved in the blues at some point has a story about being ripped off. I don't know what happened. I'm on good terms with Bobby Robinson's daughter, though, Denise. So I'll just say we kind of had it out. But lately, in my new trio, Sir Rod and the Blues Doctors, we did a cover of Freedom for My People. And it was wonderful to have our lead singer, Rod Patterson, is Sterling McGee's nephew. So that's a story of its own. But he re-sang his uncle's song in a beautiful way.
So Sir Rod the Blues Doctors, we've got Sir Rod on vocals, percussion. He's the front man, yourself on harmonica, your musical director, kind of really the driving force behind the sound. You've also got Alan Gross on drums and kind of a...
No. Alan's kind of on guitar.
Okay.
Oh, I need to correct you. I'm playing harmonica and drums. Alan's playing guitar. So one of the interesting things is sort of in 2009, 2010, I became a one-man band for a while and was doing percussion very much the way Sterling did, although a very different kind of setup. But I've done that. So I am the rhythm section, basically. I'm the drummer with Sir Rod and the Blues Doctors.
Gotcha. Booth, you want to check your facts on that one next time, buddy? Yeah. Hey, notable album from you guys recently, Keeping It in the Family 2022, kind of a legacy tribute, Where the Blues Lives.
It was a live album that we wanted to give people a sense of what it's like to do the kind of music we play. It's kind of some of its legacy stuff, some of its originals. We have a song called Brother Sterling. In fact, your blues audience might appreciate if I'd show them the rhythm part on harp that I worked out. Which is to say, this is an original harp part, but the idea that I had with this was I wanted it to sound like it had been around forever. It doesn't quite sound like it sounds like something you know you've heard before, but no, you haven't, I don't think. Let me show you what I do. Yep. And then it stops. Brother Sterling and Rod comes in. So that's the kind of groove I think Sir Rod and the Blues Doctors are keeping alive, the Satan and Adam groove. And there's no question that Rod Patterson on lead vocals, he doesn't do anything but lead vocals, which means he's a dancer too. So he's out there. We have a wonderful show. But he has a little bit of his uncle's sound, but he has the same charisma. It's almost like there's this McGee thing. And Rod is the daughter of Sterling McGee's older sister. There's a McGee. It's hard to describe. It's charisma. It's that thing that makes you. There was a film years ago about Steve Prefontaine, and the guy at the beginning says, some people have, you know, there's a thing. Some people have a lot of it. Some people have a little. Steve Prefontaine had a whole lot of it. Well, it's like Rod Patterson and Mr. Satan had a whole lot of that thing that makes them compulsive. Somebody you just want to watch. They've just got the thing that mesmerizes you, I think. They both have it.
So
it's a very physical performance. And I'm thinking back to Sterling McGee and the footage that I've seen. And it kind of ties into some of your harmonica lessons, in as much as you say, hey, you know, you're moving back and forth, but you're also moving side to side. I couldn't help but feel that correlation. Did I get that right?
Yeah, well, years ago, I remember I talking about the dance of blues harmonica. I was struck by the way that Kim Wilson moved. He has beautiful, almost balletic, you know? And I think if you watch some harp players who are really into it, they'll just get down and they're sort of conducting energies. And I think guitar players do the same thing. I'm not talking about being stagey, right? I'm not talking about Steve Vai in Crossroads, right? The whole point of, if your audience knows that movie, the whole point of Steve Vai playing, what's his name? Willie, I got a white boy of my own, Willie Brown. What's his name? God. And Steve Vai in that movie is playing kind of, what's the word? Like metalized blues rock in the mid 80s, right? With all kinds of contorted things that aren't real at all. They're just in totally stagey. What you want, I think what all of us want out of our blues players is if they're going to grimace, if they're going to, you want to look like you want them to look like they're pulling something real that's alive right now out of themselves. And you know, a little artifice is okay, but really what you want is you want to know that that the blues are active in somebody and that they're conducting them out with the help of the music. I would say the side-to-side thing, the back and forth, it's not something you can force. But it's good to acknowledge that those energies, how you carry yourself as a musician, makes a difference. When I was looking at myself in the video from 1989, what I was conscious of is I'm not moving a lot. Mm. And you know, one thing I'll take it back to something you said earlier, because this is one of the themes of my family and I. When I talk about what it was like to play in Harlem in the mid to late 80s, it was a period of racial violence. It was a period of polarization in New York City. And I talk about Howard Beach. There was a killing of a couple of black guys who went into a pizzeria in mob country in Queens and got chased out, and one got killed by a car. We were out there in Harlem during that whole, like the whole aftermath. I was not personally indicted by the people who walked by. There was a moment, though, 2 weeks after Do the Right Thing came out in the summer of 1989, in which I was challenged. What I would say is that I'm taking it back to your movement thing. I was very conscious, even though I was comfortable more or less playing with Sterling after a couple of years, playing by his side, almost like unconsciously. I also was not, I didn't want to be demonstrative. The last thing in the world I would have been was a hot dog. What you know, a white boy being a hot dog on the streets of Harlem, you'd have to be crazy. That was my feeling. So I think I held myself back. One thing that happened is as he and I moved from the streets, suddenly we got a manager who put us on tour with Bo Diddley in Europe, on 10 cities in Europe, summer of 91. And suddenly we were a national touring act in America. And I mean, we came to Montreal a couple of times and Toronto at least once. Well, there's a blues festival in an island near Toronto. I remember playing that. I forget what it's called. My point is, once we moved out and the audience we were playing for were much more white than all black, they were sort of mainstream blues audience, then I became much more comfortable in my skin in a way and was moving more. And I think but I noticed that I wasn't doing that in Harlem as much.
So the international exposure gave you the more freedom of expression. And that really comes across for the audience. You're giving it off. They're feeling it. The whole experience is more real, more visceral.
Yeah.
Really. Just want to wrap up a quick comment you made about the Crossroads the Crossroads movie because we had a very special guest, Tim Russ, who's a great bluesman. Lots of folks know him as Tuvok from Star Trek, but he's a fantastic bluesman as well. Music, very important to him all his life. He played the Robert Johnson role in Crossroads, a little dream sequence that features Robert Johnson. And he was chatting with Tim. He was on the show. We're talking about him taking lessons from Ry Cooder to get the Crossroads right. But Tim had been playing guitar since the Beatles had broken up. So he was no stranger to it. One of the guys that's portrayed Robert Johnson, in addition to Keb Moe, that can actually play like Robert Johnson. So just a little quick familial tie, and I just wanted to wrap up with your Crossroads mention there. Blues Harmonica Teaching Online. I was at your YouTube site last night. I'm having a lot of fun there, and I'm enjoying the harp lessons from the front seat. And I got the feeling, and you explained it somewhere, I can't remember where, but it's kind of like that's where you're comfortable. And it kind of makes the viewer feel comfortable. It's like we're sitting in your car there, and you're giving like a real lesson as opposed to some formal kind of, you know, play the notes. So I am enjoying that. I can imagine harp players would too. What's the big bad habit that harp players pick up early, would you say? You're welcome.
Yeah, so I think the there's maybe two, there's a couple of habits. One would be that I think it's so important to have a clear, strong, single note embouchure. So I can tell somebody who's been playing for 6 months because they don't have that in almost every case. In fact, if they do have a good embouchure, then occasionally I've run across somebody who started with my videos and they've actually got the embouchure and it's like, I learned it from you. So it is that important though. So and they have kind of mush mouth. So instead of going, which would be single notes, they go, right? It would be all of that kind of, that's one thing. Now, along with that, the shape of their mouth isn't quite right. So there I have my tongue way forward, but it's really important to create a resonating cavity in your mouth. Let me give you an example. Here's a bad player playing the one-hole draw on an A harp. Here's a good player. So all I did to go from is I dropped my jaw. If I add vibrato to it, now that's what Nat Riddles did. And that's when you start to get something that sounds right. So not being conscious of how important it is to, especially on the low notes, to shape your mouth, to create a resonating chamber in combination. So that's what I sounded like probably in 6 months when I was playing. Now I'd be. I'd add a little vibrato. I'd have a resonating cavity. And the third and final thing would be not having any control over pitch when they bend. So sometimes you'll hear people, they'll say, okay, I'm bending a note. Now that's a three hole and the person has no control over that pitch. So instead of going, I used to joke and say, no, you don't want Middle Eastern Mary had a little lamb. You know, no, that's too far. Right. It's a different scale. That's not blues. That's not major scale. So getting some control over the pitches and really understanding where the blues pitches hide out. So sometimes I'll go, baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go. I've long been fascinated by kind of where that bluesiness hides out in pitch terms. Baby, please don't go. And what I'm really doing, because I've listened really hard to good blues singers, and one takeaway is it's not just a pitch halfway between major and minor, but it's kind of there's a little rising edge, right? There's a little, not, that's overdoing it. So finding the you know, the perfect zone is so important melodically as a blues player. And then, and so if I had one takeaway exercise for a harmonica player, every day, take a couple of harps and play the blues scale on it, go up and down. And then do it on your A harp. And make that last boom, that blues pitch sound good. If you do those things, you'll be a better player than you were. You just do them every day. Try your hardest. And within a couple of weeks, you'll sound better than you were.
You'll find all of the links to learn from Adam, to buy his books, to buy his audiobooks in the liner notes here. A couple of wild card questions for you, Adam, before we let you go.
Sure.
How about your weirdest gig memory that still makes you chuckle when you're up at 2 a.m.?
Well, it involves two things. It involves almost not getting paid, and it involves playing the race card in a strange way. So let me tell you this story. We had an unusual gig at a restaurant. It was kind of a gourmet restaurant run by a guy. The guy who ran it was also the chef. And it was somewhere like in Columbia County, New York. It was sort of not far upstate, but it was sort of on the way from New York City to Syracuse, kind of out in the boonies a little bit. And it was booked by our agency. And we had a full house. We played Sterling played a 2.25-hour set. It was like one endless set. He drove me to the ground, which is to say we earned our money. And we had a great meal. We earned our money. And the people who paid, many of them pay with a credit card. Now, you know, if you're booking a band, you're always supposed to have cash on hand to pay the band. That's what we were paid in, cash. It was stipulated in the contract. And the guy, I went back to collect the money when the show was over. Again, having played, I was exhausted, right? But I knew we'd given him good value, that full house. And he says, well, I'll need to give you a check. And we didn't take checks. We were paid with cash. And I said, I pointed that out, and then I said, I got up to the guy and I said, I got to be honest, Mr. Satan's not going to be happy if you try to pay us with a check. Like, I've got my black partner in there, and he's like, who knows what Mr. Satan might do? This guy from Harlem. I didn't have to say any of it. I just said, Mr. Satan's not going to be happy. And he borrowed from his employees and he paid me in cash and we got out of there. I felt bad. I felt bad that I had to suggest potentially that, I mean, it wasn't his blackness. It was the fact that who knows what a guy named Mr. Satan is capable of doing. My point is I used that card, which I had never been forced to play, and we got paid. Now, when I talked to Sterling about it, or Mr. Satan, as I called him, I talked about, he said, oh man, he told me stories, this kind of story that those old blues guys will tell you. It's like the time you're in a club and it doesn't matter if it's a white guy or a black guy sitting, and he puts the boots up on the desk and lays a Luger or some kind of six shooter right down and says, I'm sorry, we can't pay you everything tonight. You know, sorry, we just didn't make the money we hoped to make. You know, those old day stories when you're not going to get paid, and when they clearly did make the money, the guy's just not going to pay you. Sterling said, hell, I always assume I'm not going to get paid. It was so funny. His attitude was like, that's one of those things that happens. I was still kind of a straight shooter, and this guy wasn't unethical. This guy was actually in over his head. The chef owner, he hadn't had much live music. That's all it was. And I felt bad that I pushed him that way, but.
You played the race card, but you had a good excuse.
Who knows? Who knows what Mr. Satan might do? I mean, that's all I had to say. And you could see him getting nervous. He was nervous. And Mr.
Adam,
Satan was a
so
peaceful
much.
Guy. He did not carry weapons. Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks, man.
Sorry to cut you off there. It's such a pleasure having you here and hearing your stories. Really appreciate it. We'd love to have you back for another round at your leisure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt. I've got more stories up my sleeve. So next time. Take care.
That's a wrap on Talking Blues. If the blues speaks to you, hit subscribe, share the show, and let's keep the tradition alive. Until next time, keep it raw, keep it real.